KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Every summer in Alaska, there is the threat of wildfires throughout the state. This year, Mount Spur is also threatening to send volcanic ash into the air. As wildfires become more frequent and intense, the smoke they produce is not just a visible nuisance, but a serious health threat. Exposure to wildfire smoke is linked to respiratory problems, heart disease, and even premature death. Wildfire smoke and ash can greatly affect air quality and have health implications, especially for those with asthma and lung conditions. Vulnerable populations like children, the elderly, and those with pre-existing conditions are at greater risk. For today's show, we will explore the health effects and epidemiology of wildfire smoke, examining how it affects communities and what measures can help protect us. I am pleased to have pulmonologist Dr. John Grace and environmental epidemiologist Dr. Micah Hahn with us as guests today to answer all of your wildfire smoke questions. If you have a question or a comment, please give us a call toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. I want to also remind our listeners that this program will be available on demand through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Okay, Dr. John Grace, welcome to Line One. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
I'm pleased to have you today. I'd like to hear a little bit about Dr. Grace, where you trained, how you got involved in pulmonology.
I had kind of an uncommon path. I started off, I was going to do anesthesiology and decided I didn't like being stuck in an OR, and then switched to internal medicine, which is a field of medicine that specializes in sort of general medicine, and then subspecialized into lung and ICU medicine. I graduated from the University of Michigan in 2020. Which is, you recall, was not a great year to be doing ICU medicine. Came up here through a somewhat hostile Canada that did not want anybody there. And then I've been here ever since. And yeah.
Good, good. So yeah, that must have been a very, well, it's a great time to get experience during your fellowship, I presume. You know, you got to look at the silver lining, right?
Yeah, we found out, a lot of the people who were teaching us were not as good as procedures as we were, so we actually ended up doing a lot of the stuff because we were ironically more experienced than them, and, you know, came up here, and it was a little bit delayed seeing a lot of the effects up here, but we definitely had our share of sick people from that. Unfortunately, that's in the rearview mirror now, but...
Yes, thank goodness, thank did. So tell our listeners a little bit about what is pulmonology, what's the specialty entail, what are the sort of common, most common disease processes that you see on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, my office staff laughs because I always introduce myself as a lung doctor is what I tell people, because I feel like it's a little bit more approachable than a pulmonologist. But yeah, it's generally the specialty of lung medicine. So the conditions I most commonly treat are COPD, smoking-related lung disease, asthma, also scarring-related lung diseases, and then some things are a little less well-defined, like people who just keep coughing and it won't go away, people who feel short of breath and all their other doctors tell them that everything seems to be fine, people sometimes who have chest pain, thoracic disease, so sometimes the way the lungs sit in the chest get stuck to things. So just in generally all the lung related stuff. Do not do lung surgery. That's a different subspecialty, but all the other non-surgical stuff in the lung is sort of what comes to me. And there is very few of us practicing in this state. To my knowledge, there's only 4 outpatient pulmonologists for the general population of the state, and 2 of them don't do anything in Anchorage.
Yeah, so your services are in demand, I imagine.
Yes, it's very busy. I originally came up here to do ICU medicine, and I've shifted out of that primarily, almost entirely now, just to mostly do lung medicine because there is such an enormous need for it.
Yeah. Well, it's great to have you in the community. We welcome you in this community that oftentimes that's the case with multiple specialties here.
Yeah, so. Thank you.
And we have Dr. Micah Hahn with us as well. Dr. Hahn, would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I am a professor of environmental health at the University of Alaska in Anchorage, and I'm an environmental epidemiologist.
Okay. So for our listeners and myself, please explain what an environmental epidemiologist is, please.
Sure. Yeah. I'd be happy to. Well, I guess in contrast to clinical medicine, where doctors are dealing with a patient one at a time, public health or epidemiology kind of takes a bigger picture view and looks at the health of populations. And so we're often looking for patterns in diseases or health outcomes among populations. And then we try to link these to exposures or risk factors so we can understand what it is that's making people sick or protective factors. You know, what are things that are keeping people healthy? Mm-hmm. And then environmental epidemiology deals with environmental exposures. So that could be things like air pollution, like we're going to talk about today, or maybe the design of your neighborhood or access to healthy food or that type of thing, for example.
That's great. And what is your particular, passion or focus in that field?
Sure, yeah. Well, I study the health impacts of climate change, mm-hmm. and I work with communities to try to develop locally relevant and culturally relevant adaptation strategies.
Interesting. All right. So, well, let's talk, I plan to talk a little bit about the medical stuff first, but let's actually talk a little bit about more of the general wildfire stuff to get the kind of those numbers out of the way, because you sent a great PowerPoint in advance that I was able to review. And so when in my opening, we talked about how wildfires are getting more frequent and intense. Mm-hmm. And so how is that actually the case in Alaska? Because it's been raining for like a month, if no one has noticed.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, Dr. Grace, I think this was before you got here. This was probably 2018 or 2019 when we had a terrible fire season.
Yeah.
And it was 90 degrees and no one here has air conditioning, so we couldn't open our windows and it was miserable. But we haven't had that since then. Mm-hmm. So when people say it's getting more frequent and intense, what's the numbers show?
Well, so you mentioned, it's been raining a lot this season. And I think it's important to sort of, again, look at the big picture and look at the trends over time. And so what we're seeing is there are more frequent and more severe wildfire seasons. And often we'll look at things like the number of acres burned per season as sort of an indicator of how bad that fire season was. And what we're seeing is that there are more really big fire seasons, like over 2 million acres burning in a season within Alaska, which is huge. There's a lot of different reasons for this, and a lot are related to climate change. So things like warmer summers, warmer nighttime temperatures in the summertime, and so that's increasing fire conditions. We're having a much shorter snow season. So, you know, our snow is melting earlier in the spring, and then it doesn't start falling until later in the fall. And so that just kind of compresses the window, expands the window of when we see our wildfire seasons burning. I mean, actually, the dates that we consider our wildfire season have actually changed in policy. And so it goes from now April to September. And so that's a longer amount of time when people could potentially be exposed to wildfire smoke.
Yeah. What was it? What was it before? And when did it change?
It was May. And then in 2019, actually, that year, the fire season went through September. And so they expanded the dates that year also.
Okay. So we're seeing hotter summers and lower, shorter snow seasons. Mm-hmm. And then also like increased lightning strikes. Is that
what's happening? Yeah. A lot of our fires in Alaska are initiated by lightning strikes. And so when you have the perfect conditions, you have sort of a dry vegetation, it's really warm outside, and you have a lightning strike that is particularly in a remote or rural area that can really create the conditions that we need to see for more frequent wildfires.
Yeah, and I saw one of your slides showed that there was overall more smoky days per year over the last, I don't forget how long it showed, but last decade or so.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the trend. If you are seeing more wildfires, more likely you're going to have more smoky days. And actually, we can talk, I'm sure we'll get to it, but the concentration of that smoke is really important in thinking about the potential health impacts for people.
Yeah, and then it mentioned that about during those periods of smoky time, there was a, you know, a 13% increase in ER visits for asthma-related complications. So you're linking the smoke directly to admissions or, I guess, ED visits.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a study that we did looking at smoke and ED visits in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Matsu Valley. And so basically we looked between 2015 and 2019 at we have air quality monitors in those locations so we could look and see every day what were the smoke conditions. And then from the state health department, they collect all of the ED admissions, all the folks that you guys are seeing get compiled into a database that can then be used for this kind of research. And we can connect the days that people come in with complaints about lung or cardiovascular conditions and what the smoke conditions were. We can basically look back in time to see where were there connections and were there spikes in different health outcomes depending on what the smoke conditions were.
Yeah, and that's where Dr. Grace comes in. You know, we have people come into the emergency room. I'm sure you get calls or your office number starts to go up in volume because people are suffering from, you know, possible lung issues. So what are the, I guess what are in general the short-term, long-term effects of smoke inhalation or environmental smoke?
Yeah, I think it's
a big question. I'm sorry.
It is, yeah. And, you know, I think it's important, you know, the size of the, so when we're talking about smoke, it's the particulates in the smoke, and you're probably way better equipped to talk about that than me.
Kick it off, and I can follow up.
Yeah, and, you know, from a lung perspective, it really gets divided into these particulates that are less than 2.5 microns, and then there are bigger categories, but the other commonly at least studied one, I think, is the 10 micron size, and so, like, 10 micron size is, it's like bigger stuff, and that's more like pollens, allergens, things that don't penetrate through deeper into the lung. It kind of sits on the epithelial, the skin surface inside the lung, but doesn't get deeper into the body, and that can trigger allergic responses. But the smaller stuff, the 2.5 micron particulates, those definitely go through the epithelial walls, get into the cells, and that causes different kinds of problems that are oftentimes harder to see and more severe. But yeah, I think so depending on that, if you look at the available epidemiologic data, the 2.5 micron particulate matter is definitely more hazardous to health than the larger materials. And from a pragmatic perspective, yes, when there is a huge amount of pollution in the air, people, even people without lung conditions, will start to exhibit respiratory symptoms, you know, have worsening shortness of breath. There's a lot of people out there who have either undiagnosed, underdiagnosed, or subclinical asthma, who, you know, live their day-to-day life with no problems, and now they have this huge stress test and they're going to fail it, and then eventually, at a certain concentration, everybody's going to have trouble breathing, no matter how healthy your lungs are. So it's definitely a dose-dependent effect.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me give our listeners our call-in numbers again, just as a reminder. Toll-free statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Fairbanks, if you're listening, we'd love to hear from you. I know us folks in Anchorage hear a lot about the Fairbanks smoke, mm-hmm. So please give us your calls. So Dr. Grace, let's talk about more of the short-term or immediate effects that we might see on, you weren't here for 2019. I'm sure you heard about it.
I drove through the burned out forest on my way out of Canada I saw the wide swath of destroyed forest up there. When I was driving through, I actually didn't know that had happened. I just thought it was normal for a bunch of burned out forest to be up there, but that must have been what it was.
Well, you know, in Anchorage, we have this bowl, and I know it's similar in Fairbanks, but the smoke can just kind of sit right here depending on the winds and everything. And so what do we look out for? What are the symptoms that people will see immediate term with, you know, a little bit of smoke versus a lot of smoke, or does it change?
You know, I think, you know, people exhibit things or will experience things differently, but generally speaking, people who are going to develop symptoms, usually for the vast majority of people, it's going to start as sort of like a tightness in the chest, which can be a lot of things. But in respiratory, you know, from a lung perspective, what that generally means is like the air is starting to get stuck, like you're not getting the air out as effectively. And then that tightness in the chest will, you know, in people where it's going to get worse, will start to get worse and then sometimes develop into like a wheezing sound, that high-pitched sound as they breathe out. And eventually, even when they breathe in, as the air is increasingly trying to squeeze through tighter spaces. You know, if that continues to progress, it can become a life-threatening emergency. So there's often early warning signs that your breathing is not going to be doing so hot, and responding to those quickly is really your best chance at trying to prevent that from becoming a bigger problem, and sort of listening to your body and knowing that it's going to be a problem are important, which is again why it's really important for people who don't have lung problems at you know, on a day-to-day basis might not realize that is what, you know, what they're experiencing, especially younger people that generally eschew healthcare. Will, you know, shrug it off like, oh, I just ate something weird, or, you know, something weird's happening, but it'll go away. But, you know, if we're constantly being exposed to smoke, it's not going to go away and it can get worse.
Okay. Well, we have a call coming in. Todd from Anchorage, welcome to line one.
Thanks, guys. Good, timely topic. So I'm wondering about the efficiency and efficacy of these indoor, in-home air purifiers and filters. You know, they go from these little bedside units and ozone generators and filters. And then I've got one that's one of these 4-foot cylindrical creatures, industrial type with a strong fan. And so it sucks all the air through it. But I don't know how good those really are. All of them, you know, it's a big topic, but especially for the micro, teeny-weeny particles and the nasty stuff.
Yeah, that's a great question, Todd. Well, we have a couple experts here that I'll pose your question to. Thank you. Who wants to tackle this first?
I mean, I can say that, Todd, I bet there are a number of different filters out there on the market, and so I think it's just really important to sort of look at the specs for each of the one, and sort of the one of the things that you want to look for is the filter size, that it's actually the particle size that it's actually filtering for. As Dr. Grace mentioned, thinking about the really tiny particles is important, so trying to make sure that the filter size that you're using is actually filtering those out is really important. And then in general, looking to resources that were of folks that have already done tons of testing. So for example, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has a ton of wildfire and smoke resources on their website. And so if you go there, they have listed specific filters that they know do well, or specific characteristics that you can look for. And so that's where I would send you to just really make sure that the specific model that you're using is actually achieving what you're trying to do and protecting you from the wildfire smoke.
Yeah, and it might be great for, you know, pets or things like that, but not good for wildfire smoke, and there's probably different varieties. Mm-hmm. Dr. Grace, what do you hear from your patients? What do you recommend?
I try not to talk about air filters too much, but there are different species of them, and they're the ionizing ones, which I think the caller alluded to, is... those are, you know, they do filter the air, and I think they do grab the smaller particle sizes, but they also, like you said, produce ozone. And ozone is kind of like, it's like a liquid bleach almost for the lung. So it's highly reactive. It can damage DNA within the body when you breathe it in. Now, it's probably not producing ozone and nearly enough to actually cause any serious damage. But, you know, if we were trapped inside for a month producing ozone and breathing that in constantly, that could begin to cause problems. So you do need to be cautious about anything that's producing ozone, because it's very toxic to the lung, and it's not something we want to be breathing in. And up here in Alaska, it's not as big of a deal, because ozone production naturally at like the surface level where we're breathing it generally requires like a lot of heat to form and late afternoon. And generally speaking, up here, it doesn't get hot enough, I don't think. But although you might have something else to say about that. But I think like in like metros, like I grew up in Southern California, on the asphalt, you know, it was like 115 degrees. Like definitely we were getting ozone there. But if you're producing it in your home, you know, in a, you know, a sealed environment, that that dose could be a lot more significant.
Okay, so maybe ozones aren't great for us, but other filters may be helpful in these situations.
Right, and that's only the electric ionizing ones, like the HEPA filter ones will not produce ozone. Those are the ones that use electricity to filter things that produce the ozone.
Okay.
I'm just going to add on to that to say, yes, look for HEPA filters for sure. And then also, you know, I know that air filters can be very expensive. And so there has been a lot of research of people trying to look for like a DIY box fan filters that you can create for your home. And so, again, on the EPA website, but on other places, you can actually find plans to buy like a, you know, a low cost box fan and attach a filter to it and can really improve the air quality in your house. So if you feel like it's too expensive to go out and buy a brand new filter, that might be an option for potentially improving the air quality, particularly if you have a sensitive person in your house, someone, an asthmatic or an older person, for example.
Yeah, yeah, and we'll talk next about pre-existing conditions and whatnot. We do need to take a short break here. You are listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage, 907-8433, 907-550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on the health effects and epidemiology of wildfire smoke with pulmonologist Dr. John Grace and environmental epidemiologist Dr. Micah Hahn.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you responsible for a growing team of healthcare workers? Now's the time to invest in your team. When you enroll by June 30th, the Alaska Primary Care Association will cover the full cost of training and apprenticeship programs to help your employees get certified, advance their skills, and stay within your organization. Visit alaskahealthcarecareers.com to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Primary Care Association.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by pulmonologist Dr. John Grace and environmental epidemiologist Dr. Micah Hahn. And we are discussing the health effects and epidemiology of wildfire smoke. If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, we have a call coming in at Kelly in Anchorage. Kelly, welcome to Line 1.
Hi.
Hi. What can we answer for you, Kelly?
So I just had a question. So I'm very active with my family outside, and I know the wildfire season is upon us. I was wondering what precautions or signs to look out for me and my family, you know, just like biking, hiking, going out camping, things like that.
That's right. It's a beautiful weekend ahead of us. As Alaskans, we love our outdoor activities. So that is definitely a consideration when we're having environmental issues. That's a great question, Kelly. So, Dr. Hahn, let's start with you.
Kelly, that is such a great question and is probably on the top of all Alaskans' minds, because what do we like to do in the summer? Go outside and recreate, right? Well, we were Dr. Grace and I were chatting before the show, and we were talking about the importance of prevention and really trying to decrease their chances of being exposed to wildfire smoke. And so I think really the key thing to do is keep your eye on the AQI, is what I say. So the AQI is the Air Quality Index, and that is something that the EPA has put out based on epidemiologic studies. And Dr. Grace mentioned this, but like there's a dose response effect. So basically, it's really important not only to know that there's smoke in the air, but to know the concentration of that smoke. And at different concentrations, we expect that, you know, between 0 and 50, it's good air quality, it's green light, you can go outside, take your family. As that concentration gets higher, you know, this is the time when maybe if you have a pre-existing condition, if you're an older person, maybe that's when you need to start thinking about going inside. And as that concentration gets higher and higher, that's sort of the alert to say anyone should not be going outside. It doesn't matter if you're a healthy person or not. This is not something that you want to be exposed to. So, and I can talk a little bit more about this maybe if you, in the follow-up questions, but there are some really great resources in Alaska where you can go to look at the current AQI right now where you are, but also forecasts the next couple of days what we think the smoke is going to be doing. And so you can use that to plan, you know, where are you going to go, south to the Kenai? Are you going to go north up towards Dalkeetna? Where do we go to sort of avoid the major smoke plumes and what we're expecting over the next few days?
Oh, that's a great resource. And we can also link that on our website afterwards, sure, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Dr. Grace, comments on outdoor activities for our listeners.
Yeah, I think a good question would be, does anybody in your family have like asthma or any other lung issues?
I have asthma, and my daughter, who's 4, has reactive airway disease.
Yeah, and that reactive airways disease, as you know, is kind of like a precursor term or somebody who's at risk, but maybe not like a full-blown asthmatic. And I think, again, early symptom recognition is important. So for people who don't have highly symptomatic disease or it's infrequent bouts, you know, so you're not having to interact with the healthcare system very often for your lung disease, is being in tune with your body and knowing when something feels off, because asthma, especially in people at risk for it, and, you know, eventually at a higher concentration, even people not at risk for it, will creep up on people, and it can happen very fast. And especially if you're out in a remote area, far from medical resources, and if you're not equipped and don't have emergency inhalers, that can become rapidly escalating into becoming a life-threatening problem. And every year, even independent of wildfires, there's a few people that die of asthma every year, and it's always related to sort of under-recognition of symptoms, late presentations. And again, what you're looking for in the vast majority of people is going to be some, you know, some shortness of breath, like I'm a little bit more winded doing things that I'm used to doing without being winded, that chest tightness, wheezing, you know, everybody kind of experiences it differently, but just realizing that something's off and then being able to link it to your breathing or your lungs and then responding to that appropriately, whether, you know, that's using an emergency inhaler if you have one, calling your doctor, going to the emergency room if it's that bad. But it's early symptom recognition is critical.
Okay. And you know, we had talked previously about the importance of having inhalers around or regular use of a preventative. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, inhalers are prescribed. You sadly can't pick one up over the counter. But so for people with any kind of underlying reactive airways disease or asthma, the Global Initiative for Asthma, GINA, they're sort of like the World Clearinghouse on Asthma Guidelines, now actually recommends that everybody who's using an emergency inhaler also be dosing it with an inhaled steroid, which is a really strong anti-inflammatory medication. And the reason for that is that if something is causing your lungs to seize up, you don't just want a temporary Band-Aid that's going to open them up for a few hours and then be gone. You want to be sort of applying a salve to it, and that's what that steroid does. So sort of combining that albuterol with an inhaled steroid, and the Europeans have been doing this since the early 2000s, and something called a smart dosing. There's an inhaler approved in the United States now that combines both of those medications, but it's astronomically expensive, so we still bootstrap it with the old school, you know, you have to carry around two inhalers situation. But you know, I feel like that evidence is not commonly followed up here. So, you know, I try to equip patients of mine who are not on inhaled steroids consistently all the time that, you know, if they're just going to be using inhalers on an as-needed basis, they need to be combining that with an inhaled steroid. And I've been trying to slowly rotate that into people as I catch up with them, because that was an updated guideline about a year or two ago by Gina. That's
great. Okay. Yeah, that's great to know. Mm-hmm. So for, can smoke increase the likelihood of developing respiratory conditions or things like lung cancer over time?
Absolutely. There is epidemiologic data on that. I believe the PM2.5 is that less than 2.5 microns is actually classified as a carcinogen by, I can't remember the name, it's one of the cancer societies. The dose, the exposure and dose are obviously are important, and the amount of time you're exposed to it are important. It's hard to classify exact risks, you know, like a one-time exposure to smoke is probably not going to significantly increase your risk of cancer, but long-term exposures, especially in probably the best, most analogous data we have are people who use wood-burning stoves as a heat source and grew up around it, so they were exposed to it very frequently throughout their childhood. Most of that data is more directed into developing chronic lung conditions like COPD, but there's certainly a signal for increased cancer risk, although we're not really, I don't think I'm really able to totally quantify it, although you might have some more specific numbers.
No, I think you're spot on. I was just going to say that it's actually a good question, and it's really an existing question in terms of what do we think the health impacts are going to be of this long-term risk, because exposure to wildfire smoke is no longer sort of an episodic thing that happens once every 10 years in Alaska and in the western U.S. People are exposed to wildfire smoke every summer. So it's from an epidemiologic perspective, we've treated it as an acute exposure, meaning like, oh, you're exposed today or maybe tomorrow, or maybe once in every few years. But we need to be thinking about it more as a chronic exposure, like wood stove smoke. And so the methods really haven't like caught up with the reality of what people are experiencing. And so, you know, our best analogy within the epidemiologic literature is looking at wildland firefighters, for example. So mm-hmm. that's a group of people who do have chronic exposure, and it's sort of like a controlled population. Like, you can equip them with monitors and actually, you know, measure their lung function over a long time. And in those types of studies, we have seen long-term cancer risk. And again, you know, those folks aren't really generalizable to the full population. These are usually healthy young people. And mm-hmm. so you can imagine, you know, if you were to sort of extrapolate to the general population, that risk would probably be even higher.
Wow, that's super interesting. I'd never thought about the wood-burning stoves. I don't have one in my house, but I love them, and I used to have one and always want one. But maybe the gas ones are just as good. I know hasn't there been a real push up in the, especially the Fairbanks area, to get rid of the wood-burning stoves, not just for the health risks, but mostly for the air quality in that area.
There's been a lot of work in Fairbanks to improve air quality, and a lot of that is driven by the outdoor air quality. So, you know, nationally we have clean air standards, and so cities have to hit certain thresholds or stay below them in terms of the air quality. And Fairbanks has historically been out of attainment a few times, which has sort of created this impetus for improving the air quality. As you mentioned, that bowl sort of sucks all of the smoke, and it stays down really low to people. And so, yeah, there's been work in either thinking of alternative warming sources, but also they're just switching out people's wood stoves. So there are newer, more modern wood stoves that can really help filter out some of the bad stuff. And so you don't necessarily have to get rid of your wood stove, but you do want to make sure that you're using a modern one and that you're always burning dry wood is another one. You know, anyone who's built a campfire knows that if you're using wet wood, it's way smokier. So making sure you're using really dry fuel can help also decrease that smoke.
Yeah. Just a reminder of our call-in numbers for our listeners, 888-353-5752 in Anchorage, 907-550-8433. So I guess before we take our second break here, let's talk about masks or respirators, because, you know, I think we all have a little bit of maybe some PTSD from the COVID era. You know, I was in the hospital a lot wearing N95s and have marks and lines on my face, and you know, and your husband, you mentioned, is a nurse, and I think a lot of people, you really don't like wearing masks for a good reason. But can a mask help in a situation where we're having wildfire smoke? Mm-hmm. We can also add an ash, maybe, from mm-hmm. this volcano threat that hasn't developed, but. And what type of mask? So I'm going to throw this one to Dr. Grace first.
So that's actually one of sort of a, it is a guideline to, it's considered a low efficacy attempt to try to control for it. Again, you're looking at that PM 2.5, that super tiny stuff, because that's the stuff that gets in, causes DNA damage, causes inflammation, that. So the only kind of masks that are going to filter those out are appropriately fitted N95, N99, P100 masks. So these are like the tight masks, not like cloth masks, homemade masks, paper masks, surgical masks. Like you need like an industrial grade mask that is appropriately fitted. Like it would not fit on you because you have facial hair. It probably wouldn't fit on me because I have some stubble. It needs to be fit tested. So pragmatically speaking, it's very ineffective to like recommend that to people, because I think the vast majority of people that will try to put that on with no training or fit testing are probably going to have enough leak in there where it's not going to be doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Okay. So our standard kind of masks that we homemade and wore, I mean, it'll keep the big stuff from mm-hmm. going into our mouth, but not the small stuff. Is that right?
Yeah. Again, it'll, you know, it might help with some allergen filtration, but it's not going to protect you from the highly damaging stuff that we're really trying to avoid.
Okay. Dr. Hahn, any comments on this?
Dr. Grace was spot on that. I mean, from a public health perspective, we know they can be effective, but they have to be used properly. And, you know, people aren't going to, I'm looking to you guys who've worn them professionally for any amount of time, like, no one wants to be hiking in an N95 mask. So it's just, I think when you use them correctly, they're uncomfortable enough that it's not going to facilitate you doing fun stuff outside. So practically, it's probably not a great solution. If you do have to be outside, maybe you're an outdoor worker, maybe you're a flagger, and you're helping with road construction or that kind of thing, and you have to be outside in an occupational setting, it might be something that is worth looking into as a policy for a business or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's take our second and last mid break here, and then we'll talk a little bit more about our wildfire smoke. You're listening to Line One, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage, 907-550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion on the health effects and epidemiology of wildfire smoke and volcanic ash with pulmonologist Dr. John Grace and environmental epidemiologist Dr. Micah Hahn.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org, wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't wait 24 hours to report a missing person. As soon as you suspect someone is missing, call your local law enforcement or 911 to make a report. Be ready to provide as much descriptive information as possible to help locate your friend, family member, or loved one. Your reporting can make all the difference, and maybe even save a life. Learn more about Alaska's Village Public Safety Officers at vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Village Public Safety Officer Program.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by pulmonologist Dr. John Grace and environmental epidemiologist Dr. Micah Hahn, and we're discussing the health effects and epidemiology of wildfire smoke. If you have a question or a comment, again, call us toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's talk a little bit about vulnerable populations, as I think that's important to define what those are and what happens in those populations. Some of the ones that I can think of off the top of my head are going to be children. elderly patients, pregnant women, people with underlying lung disease. So we can take them one at a time. But what considerations are there or data? I'll start with you, Dr. Hahn, about vulnerable populations or children in epidemiology studies.
Sure. And yeah, I can tell you a little bit about what we know from looking at sort of like the big picture again. And then I'm really curious actually to hear, Dr. Grace, if that lines up with what you see in the clinic. So you mentioned, yeah, kids are one that we think about a lot. I mean, they, compared to adults, they often spend a lot of time outside. They are running around and doing vigorous exercise. They have a higher breathing rate. And so all of these things mean that they sort of inhale more smoke per body weight than their counterparts, us adults. And so their exposure is a little bit higher. Also, their lungs are still developing. And certainly any kids with asthma, all of this extra smoke can really start triggering some of those symptoms. You said older adults, you know, tend to have a decreased immune function, maybe have pre-existing conditions, heart or lung issues. And so additional smoke sort of stressing out those systems can cause problems for them. We think a lot about pregnant women. You know, mostly we're concerned about their own health, but obviously the health of their fetus. And we, from epidemiologic studies, we know that there are links to things like preterm birth and low birth weight. And actually, I'm leading a study here in Alaska to look at the same thing to see if we're seeing those impacts over the past 20 years in our state. And then to add on that, I guess I would say the other things we think about are exposure. So like who spends a lot of time outside? I mentioned outdoor workers. So we do a ton of construction and road maintenance and yard maintenance or landscaping stuff in the summer. So all of those folks are outside. Our houseless population, people who don't have a place to go to get away from the smoke. Or maybe people who don't have the resources to buy a HEPA filter, or maybe English isn't their first language and they aren't accessing a lot of the preventative messages or the air quality alerts and that kind of thing. So those are some of the populations we tend to think about when we're worried about sort of vulnerable populations and wildfire smoke. But I'm super curious to hear if any of that aligns with what you've seen in your practice.
Let's take it one by one, Dr. Yeah. Grace, so we don't get overwhelmed. But do you see children in your practice? Or
no.
Not as part of your practice,
enough of those at home.
But I imagine in your training and studies, you've have information on children and in this particular situation.
Yeah, there's definitely you see this bimodal spike in age. So there's the under 18 and the over 65, and you see that, you know, in almost exponential fashion with particulate matter exposure, you start to see increases in emergency room visits. And I know you said you did some data here, and that's mm-hmm. great, because they've done it like in other states mm-hmm. like New York and other places where there's wildfires, and you definitely see these people showing up to the emergency room. You know, the clinic. But I mean, again, it's hard for people to get in to see me with any kind of urgency. So a lot of the time, if there's like a problem, they're going to their primary care doctor or an urgent care or an emergency room. And those are sort of the where people usually get sort of like unanticipated, somewhat urgent medical care. And I'm certain that there are anytime that the smoke increases in the air, there's a huge spike in those populations. Although, you know, of course, people in between those two, depending on their underlying medical conditions as well. But age at both ends of the spectrum are going to put you at risk.
Okay. So in kids, it's a lot of times asthma flare-ups or reactive airway disease issues. In our older population, I know one of the slides mentioned about a 30% increase in visits to the emergency room for kind of cardiovascular mm-hmm. complaints, which you can allude or expound on what those are. Mm-hmm. But is that what you're seeing as well, Dr. Grace, in terms of cardiovascular increased visits?
Yeah, I think that's a big one too, because again, you get that chest tightness, chest pain. That's, you know, frequently if you do the bigger, more important thing to rule out than asthma is, you know, make sure you're not having a heart attack. So, and that's in a medical emergency, and certainly there is a linkage with increased cardiovascular mortality and particulate matter exposure, because it does kind of, again, put that reactive stress within your body as that stuff starts to get into your blood and increase inflammation, which can cause clots and plaques to rupture, and which can cause cardiac events in people at risk for that. So it's certainly a much higher risk for that. And, you know, that's just as, if not more life-threatening than respiratory problems related to it.
Yeah. Well, what about, there's been some talk or studies out there, and I don't know if these are how accurate or whatnot, but about, you know, chronic wildfire smoke inhalation regarding cognitive function in both developing children, but also in elderly. Is there any data out there on that?
Well, definitely thinking about, you know, the very tiny particles, again, PM2.5 can cross the blood-brain barrier, which is sort of this layer that sort of usually tries to protect our brain from all of the bad stuff. And they're so small that they can get into the brain and cause inflammation, which I'll kick it to Dr. Grace to talk about, like, the sort of biological mechanism there. But certainly there's, like, a biological plausibility. You know, this is something that we know can be linked together in looking at wildfire smoke and cognitive function for sure.
Okay. Yeah. Any comments on that, Dr. Grace?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's plausible. I think another way that, you know, it could be on outside of an inflammatory explanation would be, you know, again, if people are having their airways to seize up, tighten, especially in people with COPD who aren't that great at absorbing oxygen out of the air we breathe, if their oxygen numbers start to get sort of below a critical threshold, that can begin to slowly impair cognitive function, and that's something that isn't necessarily apparent. The only way to really know that is with an oxygen meter on the finger, which, you know, people who are at risk for that, I try to get them to get one. They're pretty cheap. You can buy them at, you know, drugstores or online, and they're fairly accurate, but most people think that they'd feel short of breath if their oxygen levels are low, and that just isn't true. The brain isn't programmed to detect those. So the only way to really know if your oxygen levels are lower is with one of those little finger meters. And if that was, for example, 88% or lower, that would be a reason to go seek immediate medical care. And that could be linked to a respiratory problem. So I could imagine how that could be impacting cognitive function.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes you don't really know until it gets too low. I had one of those when I was hiking in some high altitude areas in Nepal, and I was shocked at my oxygen saturations, just sitting, eating dinner at 80%. And you're like, okay, well, that's why I have a headache.
Wow.
So they're very cool and very useful, I guess, especially if there's an exposure incident. What are some of the geographic factors that increase the likelihood of wildfire smoke exposure from a public health perspective? Things like, you know, urbanization, or I know we mentioned that, you know, Fairbanks and Anchorage are kind of bowls, so that's a geographic function. But you know, proximity to forests, things like that. I mean, we have a lot of fire risk here in Anchorage, as well as are these. You know, what are the geographic factors, Dr.
Sure.
Han?
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's see. I mean, I think. I guess on a very big picture, like not just in Alaska, but in the United States generally, we're seeing a lot more people building, you know, as cities are getting bigger, houses are sort of spreading out and encroaching on all of our natural spaces, right? So we have a lot more houses at this interface between woods and the city. And of course, that's a really pleasant place to live. So where people are physically close to where wildfires are, and certainly in Anchorage and Fairbanks, that's the case because we're in a very confined area, and so we kind of live amongst the trees in that way. But actually, more than geography, I mean, one important point to note is that you don't necessarily need to be close to the wildfire to be exposed to the smoke. We know that wildfire smoke travels downwind and can really affect like a much larger area than where the wildfires are occurring. So if we think about Alaska, for example, I think, you know, down here in Anchorage, we tend to think of wildfires as being an interior problem, right? We know this is something that Fairbanks folks have to deal with every summer, but we only see it on a one-off basis. And if you look at the fire history, like where we have seen burned areas, that is certainly the case. It's sort of across the swath of interior Alaska. But actually, we've done a study looking at the wildfire smoke history across the state over the past 20 years, and we've found that basically 98% of Alaska has been affected by smoke. And so smoke is a much bigger problem than where the specific wildfires are.
Okay. So, yeah, the smoke's moving around. I remember that big one we had in 2019. It was mostly down in the Kenai area, and so the smoke came up here from there.
Yeah. We had about 3 months of smoke that summer, actually. in Anchorage. Yeah. It was a really, it was a long one.
It was. It was. So Dr. Grace, I have a question here from email here, Gary and Molly, who have a question about CPAP use with smoke inhalation. That's an interesting question. I didn't really think about that in my prep, but is CPAP useful when there's smoke in the air? Should it be avoided? I guess that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, you should keep using the CPAP. The CPAPs have filters on them, but they are not, I'm almost certain they're not like HEPA-grade filters. They're like little sponges in there designed to absorb stuff. So I don't think it's going to absorb the particulate matter, but it's not going to like concentrate it any further either. And it might absorb some of the larger particles, although I can't really speak to that. But I know that generally speaking, the benefits of the CPAP are going to outweigh any potential risks associated with using it. And it's, I don't think anything's going to get worse or better per se from using the CPAP in a smoky environment. So I would say absolutely keep using it. And there might even be a tiny benefit from that filter built into the devices. Although again, I don't think it's going to replace, you know, like wearing a fitted mask or something in terms of limiting your exposure, but it might offer some smaller protection, especially as you're sleeping.
And can the positive pressure help in any way if someone's having, you know, sort of, I guess, spasms or anything like that?
That's a great question. It depends. You know, we used to
put
hospital.
You out on a limb there.
I would not recommend somebody try to treat their asthma exacerbation with a CPAP machine. If it's bad enough where you're feeling like you're having to use your CPAP like outside of your normally programmed CPAP hours, that's probably an indication you need to go to a hospital and be seen, because it means you're getting pretty bad. Yeah.
Okay. What about furnaces? Does anyone, like the house, just normal house filters, furnace filters, are those effective at all in terms of removing wildfire particulate? Do we know that?
I mean, I would say similar to the HEPA filters, there are different size filtration that you can buy. So just making sure, looking at the MERV rating on your filter and making sure that they're really meant to filter out tiny stuff is key for that.
Okay. Now, Dr. Hahn, we touched on some of this, but I just wanted to give you a chance to add any on what are the major epidemiological trends for smoke in Alaska?
Well, I'll say, again, maybe starting at the big picture for the lower 48, is that we are seeing that, you know, over the past several decades, that we're seeing increases in the frequency and severity of wildfires. A lot of that's about, you know, people getting closer to the forests. It's a history of suppression. For a long time, we've tried to put out forest fires because they've been dangerous to people. And so there's like a buildup of fuels. And, you know, in Alaska is a huge place. A lot of it's not on the road system. And so we don't fight every fire in Alaska for good reason, because it's not an effective use of resources. And so, you know, we let fires burn in places where it's an important part of the ecology and that kind of thing. But climate change is really intensifying the number and size of wildfires. So along with that, the smoke is sort of paralleling that. As we see bigger fires, we're going to see more smoke and long-term smoke. And, you know, for example, in Alaska, looking at the history of wildfire smoke exposure, we know that in interior Alaska, people have on average been exposed to unhealthy levels of smoke like one out of every 10 summer days in like the past 20 years, which is a lot of days. You know, that's a big part of your summer. You know, and in Fairbanks, where a lot of one of the biggest population in sort of the wildfire zone, in 2004 was a really bad wildfire year, unprecedented wildfire year in terms of the size. People were exposed to air quality on the 10 worst days that was equivalent to smoking either between five cigarettes on the low end of the spectrum up to 17 cigarettes a day if they spent all day outside during those peak smoky days. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, the long-term trend is more smoke and sort of heavier smoke. So it's really important to think of this as like something we should be preparing for on a seasonal basis so that we're ready to go in case it's a bad wildfire year.
Yeah. And I know you wanted to get some important stuff across to our listeners about air quality monitoring and websites that are available for us.
Yeah. I just wanted to highlight a really cool new resource that's going to be out this summer. It's called the Alaska Wildfire Explorer. So if you Google that, it'll take you right to a web page where a big map of Alaska will pop up, and you can see current air quality at all of the places where we have air quality monitors across the state. We're really lucky that our Department of Environmental Conservation monitors the air quality at several places, and then also a lot of communities have put in their own air filters and made those data public so people can see that information. In addition to seeing real-time air quality, you can see a forecast. So for the next couple of days, where do we think the smoke is going to be? And you can really use that, I think, I think it'll be a useful tool for you guys to be able to think about planning your weekends and trying to avoid wildfire smoke as much as possible.
Yeah. What's the website address for that? Do you remember?
I believe it's alaskawildfires.org. But I will verify, and we can link it on the Line 1 website. And then again, just it's Alaska Wildfire Explorer is the name of the tool. So if you Google that, it'll get you there.
Okay. And we can link that to the notes in our show afterwards, if you can provide that to us.
Absolutely.
I know our listeners would love to look at that. So we just have about 2 minutes left here before we have to close up. Great topics here. I wanted to give each of you any opportunity to get across any information to our listeners. Dr. Grace, we'll start with you.
I think from like a preparation perspective, because I think that's what a lot of people would be interested in, is there from like a tiered recommendation, you have the masks, which we know generally are not going to work for most people except clean-shaven men and you know women who have it properly fitted. And stepping up from that, you have like kind of staying indoors, and that's really dependent on how well-sealed your house is. And a step above that is sort of using those air filters again, and there's a lot of variation like we talked about in the beginning. And then sort of a step above that is leaving the area, which is obviously not pragmatic for most people. But honestly, that's about it in terms of preventing damage from it. You know, with the inhalers and everything to control symptoms, that's one thing. But we know that even when people are on appropriate therapy, if the particulate exposure is high enough, you're not going to improve or get better. So there's only so much we can do. So that is sort of like, from a pragmatic perspective, what people can kind of look into doing.
Yeah, that's excellent from a medical perspective. Thank you. Dr. Hahn, any closing thoughts here? We've got about 1 minute left.
Sure. I think, those are all great recommendations from Dr. Grace. Maybe a couple things to add are if you do have a inhaler prescription, make sure you keep it filled and take it with you when you're actually going to do, going camping for the weekend so you don't get caught off guard and far away from healthcare. And then also, I guess one other thing to think about is if you don't have the ability to buy a HEPA filter for your house, you can think about other spaces in your community that you might be able to go to get a reprieve. So go to the movie theater, check out a movie, or go to the library or the mall, somewhere where you can spend some time inside and just give yourself a break from the smoke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all great thoughts. Okay, well, that is all the time that we have for today's show, and I wanted to make sure I give a special thanks to our guest today. Dr. John Grace is a pulmonologist here in town, and Dr. Micah Hahn is environmental epidemiologist at UAA. Special thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Rachel Cassandra. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. This program will be available on demand through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been your Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.
You are listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska.
KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska, from Sitkanap to Castle Cape, today southwest winds 15 knots, seas 2 feet. Tonight southwest winds 15 knots, seas 3 feet. And Thursday, southwest winds 20 knots, seas 4 feet. Castle Cape to Cape Tolstoy, today south